wildlife, hunting, and regulation in the province of Quebec.
If you look to the origins of modern wildlife conservation strategies in Quebec, you find a system that emerges really from some long-standing understandings of the intersection of wildlife and elite society.
A conversation with Darcy Ingram. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 49 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. There's a lot of good historical writing on wildlife conservation in Canada. Historians including Janet Foster, George Colpitts, John Sanlas, Tina Liu, and others have provided excellent and important studies of the topic. But our understanding of wildlife conservation policy history has, until now, missed a key part of the story, the case of Quebec. As one of the oldest wildlife regulatory regimes in British North America, Quebec forms a critical part of North American conservation history. Conservation policy in Quebec took a unique form based around privately leased reserves, something nearly unknown in any other jurisdiction on the continent. Why was this the case? What made Quebec distinct? This is the subject of Darcy Ingram's 2014 book, Wildlife, Conservation, and Conflict in Quebec, 1840 to 1914. To learn more, I spoke with Darcy.
Darcy Ingram at the University of Ottawa.
Well, Darcy, thanks for joining us. We're discussing your book, which was published by UBC Press, called Wildlife, Conservation, and Conflict in Quebec, 1840 to 1914. And I guess the best place to start is to maybe, if you could tell listeners what makes or made Quebec's system of wildlife management distinct from other jurisdictions in North America. Why did Quebec stand out?
Sure, Sean. Well, it was a combination of things. I think there's an emphasis on land tenure and on a particular relationship between civil society and the state. And I think beyond that, a certain sort of cultural package that was better expressed in Quebec than anywhere else in North America. And if I can sort of summarize that quickly, if you look to the origins of modern wildlife conservation strategies in Quebec, you find a system that emerges really from some long-standing understandings of the intersection of wildlife and elite society. And for me, it was really the late 1850s that became kind of a watershed in terms of the work I was doing. In terms of civil society, you saw the establishment of fish and game protection clubs in Quebec City and in Montreal at the time. And in terms of the state, you saw the consolidation of the game laws and the establishment of a Fishery Act right then. And if you put all of those together, what was being expressed in those institutions really was an understanding of fish and game management that was reaching as much back to sort of feudal or old world understandings of fish and game as it was anticipating a more modern approach to these kind of things. And specifically, the protection clubs, they really saw sort of a group of elite, largely English and largely Protestant, and particularly Scottish colonists who were bringing forward certain understandings of fish and game, both in terms of being commercial resources, but also as being objects of a sporting culture in which they were immersed. And if you think about what they were doing, what they were up to at the time, they were really watching what was going on in the United States in terms of wildlife extirpations. Mm-hmm. They were seeing the effects of overfishing. They were seeing wildlife being depleted all around them. And they started to come together to really push the state to develop legislation and policy in order to manage those resources, both in terms of being food resources, but also for sporting purposes. So that was sort of the picture of civil society there. If you talk about the state and state legislation, really the key item was the Fishery Act, and that established a system of leases on the salmon rivers, specifically on the North Shore in Quebec, on the St. Lawrence and on the Gaspé Peninsula. And in terms of the Fishery Act, the idea here was to capitalize on these elite sporting interests by leasing these people salmon rivers. And the idea there is that if you lease these people salmon rivers, they could be relied on basically to manage them, and specifically to manage them as private estates. They would build dwellings, they would employ guardians, they would hire locals for various purposes, they'd spend money in the region, and in doing so, they'd establish a local presence, and beyond that, really, a sort of a local sense of authority in ways that would kind of mitigate exploitation and rampant overfishing that was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's going on in terms of the St. Lawrence and the Fishery Act. and leasing and land tenure. And at the same time, the protection clubs that are establishing themselves at this time, they're also establishing their own system of privately paid fish and game officers, and these people are patrolling the markets. They are investigating poaching reports that are made to the clubs. They are encouraged by state legislation to prosecute offenders because state legislation gives them a cut of any of the fines that are being levied in these kind of contexts.
Right.
So that's the initial sort of system as it develops that is quite unique. By the time we get to the 1880s, this has been going on for 20 years or so, and the provincial government, for various reasons, embraces this system and it embeds this system in legislation and policy. So it expands the leasing system, and instead of just leasing out the salmon rivers on the St. Lawrence, it creates a leasing system for fishing and hunting across the sort of lower section of the province. It encourages the development of fish and game clubs, and it encourages those clubs to take up leases and to start to hire private guardians and to start to enforce the fish and game laws on a broader sort of a scale. And if you sort of take that package by the 1880s or the 1890s, what we really sort of have here is I guess you could call it a P3 or a public-private partnership. We've got basically a sort of a state-administered system that places the management and the rights regarding fish and game resources basically in private hands, specifically a number of fish and game clubs and NGOs that are focused on sport-based conservation. So essentially by the turn of the century, you have the privatization of fish and game across the southern portion of the province. And in some cases, I mean, when we're talking about land tenure and leases, these are big things. In some cases, clubs would hold hundreds, if not, you know, upwards of 1,000 square kilometers. And given, just for a point of comparison, the island of Montreal is just over 500 square kilometers. So these are pretty big territories that they're taking on.
Now, just for listeners here, this is quite different from the way in which wildlife conservation policy was applied to other jurisdictions in Canada and in parts of the United States. And to underline the point here, you're talking about the province essentially, rather than creating public parks or public game reserves, selling off territory to private interests who then took responsibility for enforcing conservation law?
That's basically it. Not that the province wasn't creating parks. There were a couple of big parks, in particular Laurentides, north of Quebec City, that was established in the 1880s, and there are a couple of others as well, Tremblant and some other reserves. But by and large, that's what was happening. You ended up with, it wasn't so much selling off as leasing, because they would hold this for a number of years, 5 or 10 years, depending on the lease. But these would be renewable, so this would continue. You basically had a large-scale sort of privatization.
And this lasted for quite some time.
It lasted till really, it was well entrenched by the turn of the century, well entrenched by the First World War, and it remained the basis of the conservation system in the province for wildlife or for fish and game. Until the 1960s, that's when we started to see it problematized in the context of the Quiet Revolution. And it wasn't formally taken apart until 1977, after the election of the Parti Québécois.
So I think this is one of the most surprising things about your findings in this book. I imagine, and when I first read it, that we would see a story about Quebec that would be unique because of the French-Canadian character of the province. But instead, I think you're telling us that it's the British colonial character of Quebec that actually shaped its conservation system.
Bizarre, isn't it? Yeah, and not that, I mean, when you get into the intricacies of these things, of course, it's more complicated. But the basic line in terms of conservation, it was a British sort of, it was British influenced in terms of the people who were behind all of this. But they found in Quebec that this, you know, old sort of feudal, seigneurial kind of system and culture that it came with fitted that very well. So they were sort of overlapping or overlaying their own sort of colonial or, sorry, their own sort of old world understandings onto a particularly unique old world kind of context that existed at the time in Quebec more so than anywhere else in North America.
I mean, I guess from a modern perspective, in Canadian history, it maybe becomes easy to forget that Quebec, for the first half of the 19th century, was the most populous and most important British colony in North America.
That's true. And I mean, one of the things that it did, I think, that perhaps contributed to this is it sort of, it brought together, and Quebec is, on the one hand, the most populous at the time, and it's got that, you know, important hub of Montreal, which was such an important city for all of British North America and Canada. But it also has, you know, this incredible frontier. So these things are juxtaposed or pulled together in the context of a single colony or province. And it meant that you had this, you know, incredibly dense, ultimately urban sort of identity that was playing itself out. But that sort of frontier or that that wilderness was right on the doorstep, and it meant that these things could exist together.
And I guess that British colonial character of the leasing system was really underlined by a point that stuck out to me in the book, that the Governor General for many years had a fishing lease.
Yes, the Governor Generals were very lucky in that regard, and they really kind of expressed that elite culture, and people in the province and in Canada gravitated towards them because of that. And it was very common, whether it was Dufferin or some of the people who followed, to go out and to fish out there. And eventually this was established on the Cascapedia River, and that was held specifically for the Governor Generals. I forget the exact date when that changed, but through the 1880s, certainly. So a number of them would go out there and bring their entourage.
So most of the scholarship in environmental history of conservation in Canada and arguably in North America is primarily focused on the late 19th century and the early 20th century. But why did you begin your book in the mid 19th century, in 1840?
Well, I mentioned a minute ago that the late 1850s were important, and specifically when I was looking at some of the materials that were coming up, that period 1857-58, that's when we saw the establishment of protection clubs in Quebec and in Montreal. That's when we had the colonial legislation that was important really coming forward. So for me, I mean, the 1850s in particular, that in itself was striking, and that struck me as being fairly early. But in order, of course, to make sense of that, I had to back up a little bit, and I had to look, you know, look to where all of these laws that were being consolidated came from in the first place. I had to figure out who the people who were promoting these kind of ideas were and what they were up to in the years leading up to all of this. So that pretty quickly took me back to the 1840s. I think technically you could dig back earlier. There's certainly legislation to this effect established in the 1820s, even earlier. But I mean, for me, it was really sort of the 1840s or following, you know, the 1830s are fairly confusing given the rebellions and all of that sort of thing. The 1840s sort of made for a good starting point in terms of pulling it together. So that was part of it. The other advantage, I think, to backing up that far is it kept the project in line with the kind of time frame that John Ryger has established. And, I mean, John Ryger has that great book, American Sportsman, The Origins of Conservation. And he's able to sort of trace similar efforts back to the 1830s in the United States. So I thought, you know, given that book and given how important that was, it was worthwhile to take that story in Quebec back in a similar way. The other thing I think that jumped out more generally is I think it's worthwhile to push those boundaries a little bit when we start to think about how we locate conservation or where we locate it or when we locate conservation efforts or environmentalism in general. So I think all of those things were informing why I took it to that particular time period.
And in the book, you make the case then that if you look back that deep into Canadian history, you can see that, I mean, you characterize this as patrician values influencing the emergence of conservation. Could you explain what a patrician was and how you characterize patrician values in 19th century Quebec?
Sure. And I think that brings us back to some of the stuff we talked about a second ago. But again, the people behind this, the development of this system, they were largely British. And they were from England, and in particular, they were from Scotland. They were, if we can sort of lump them together, they were relatively wealthy. Sometimes their money was you know, new money made in the colony. But they really saw their identity very much in terms of the old world, and they bought into that package in terms of elite culture and landowning society, and the idea that one would express one's wealth and one's identity through things like land. and estate management and sporting culture and that sort of thing. And some of the earliest folks in this regard, I mean, they made their money in Canada and then they went, or British North America, and then they went back to England or they went back to Scotland and they spent their money, they set themselves up in that way, they bought estates, they spent their time hunting and they spent their time fishing and that sort of thing and retired to that kind of a life and fulfilled that identity that way. For other ones, for the ones who stayed in Quebec, I think they discovered in Quebec a world in which it was relatively easy to express themselves in this way. Some even went so far as to establish themselves as seigneurs formally. They sort of kicked up that feudal identity that really fitted quite well with how they wanted to package themselves. And some of them really sort of saw themselves as being the vanguard of the old world in the new world. So that was a part of it. The other thing, though, because, of course, we're only talking about relatively few people in terms of, you know, that kind of identity, the other thing that fed into this is status. Some of these people were quite wealthy, but there were many others who we might think of as, you know, fitting more into what we might call the middle class in the 19th century that gravitated towards this identity, and they found it possible to connect themselves through sport, through hunting, through fishing, to this elite sort of landowning kind of identity, and that made for a much broader base of support in terms of putting all of this together. The last thing I'd sort of underscore in terms of this patrician kind of culture is they were really promoting, or they really saw themselves as improvers. If we think about what that word meant, they looked to this idea of improvement, something based originally in sort of agriculture and landowning society, and they tried to apply that understanding of improvement to fish and game resources and to manage these resources in order to improve them for sport, but initially they were also very interested in improving them as food resources more generally. So they brought that sort of ethos to what they were doing as well.
And so their outlook on conservation wasn't exclusively for the purposes of sport. I think this is quite unique in conservation history in Canada, that there was sensitivity or attention given toward subsistence uses of wild animals.
There was, yeah. This improvement sort of ethos, but it speaks to this, you know, quasi-feudal noblesse oblige sort of identity that's embedded in patrician culture. I think that, I mean, they are, I mean, they're viewing the colony, they're sort of local or regional managers of, you know, colonial kind of estates. That's how they're kind of thinking of themselves in a lot of ways. And they see that, you know, managing fish and game in the same way that they might see managing agriculture. These are resources that people rely on. These are food resources for the populace, and we need to manage them in such a way that we not only retain them, but we actually improve them in terms of numbers and availability and that sort of thing. So yeah, there was this, again, it harkens back to a different kind of understanding of conservation embedded more in landowning society and estate management kind of activities and attitudes and practices than it does into a more strictly sport-oriented approach to conservation.
Now, you have these elite individuals in the narrative in your book, but their clubs and associations seem to play a significant role here. How important were these clubs and associational culture in this period to the development of conservation policy in Quebec?
They were key. They were really important, Sean. I mean, they did. I mean, if we think about what they did, they basically did all of the work. They leased the land. They employed the bulk of the surveillance force in terms of guardians and overseers and the like. They were in regular contact with politicians and with civil servants, pushing them to develop policy. And in a few cases, they were the politicians or the civil servants, so they overlapped in that way. So they really played a key role across the board. That's not to say that the relationship was seamless. If you want to complicate it a bit more, I think overall the protection clubs and the fish and game clubs, they were not particularly happy with what they saw to be a pretty weak commitment on the part of the province to, say, employing effective guardianship. They weren't happy with the province's role in protecting fish and game resources and employing officers. They were pushing for stronger legislation all of the time and these sorts of things. But if you compare their influence to the influence of many people who basically ended up locked out of the sporting world by what was effectively a massive privatization project, I mean, there really is no contest. And that system, it held in place despite the complaints from the rural population, despite the complaints that came from sportsmen who were outside of the system. And it really sort of continued as the province's basic framework for fish and game conservation well into the 20th century, right through to the 1970s.
Well, how effective was it, particularly in the early years of the establishment of these leasehold reserves? Was this an effective system of conservation?
It varied. It varied a lot, and it depended a lot on the lessee, if we bring it down to that level. In some cases, these people who were leasing these territories, they invested a lot of time and a lot of money into their holdings, and they had a lot of territory. And they would build accommodations for their club members. They would build other infrastructure. They'd set out pathways and this sort of thing, and build other infrastructure. They would establish an effective system of guardians, and they would maintain some sort of year-round presence on the site. And again, in some cases, we're talking about huge, huge territories. In some cases, they became involved in fish stalking, even stalking small game, killing off predators would be common sort of practice in some cases. So that's the sort of one end of the equation. In other cases, lessees, they invested little, if anything, into their sites and did very little in terms of management. And in a few cases, leases, they were really leases in name only. There was very little else going on. The one area that I would point to, perhaps in terms of sketching out successes and failures, is the salmon rivers on the North Shore and the Gaspé Peninsula. And I think if you look to the work some other people have done and look to what was going on at the time and look to the pattern that was taking shape across eastern North America in terms of the extirpation of various fisheries, inland fisheries, it's a pretty safe bet that those rivers on the Gaspé Peninsula and the North Shore, they'd have been wiped out in terms of salmon had it not been for the leasing system and for the tremendous interest and the investment that was put toward their management in this way. Perhaps the other aspect to consider in that equation is the fact that, again, what we're really looking at here is the state relying on private interests in order to put together a system of fish and game conservation. And that was being done because the state wasn't willing to invest directly in that management process itself. Mm-hmm. Its interest was or its solution was to harness private interests to do that. And I think had it not done that, you might have ended up with something very different as well.
Do you suppose, though, that the patchy character of the effectiveness of the leasehold system was reflective of the private implementation of conservation law? It's sort of in the absence of a centralized state authority?
Definitely, and there were complaints about that among lessees. A lessee who invested a lot of money in their particular site and had guardians and that sort of thing would effectively just end up pushing poachers and pushing people who were taking fish and game onto territories around them. So there was that dynamic playing itself out that people complained about all of the time. Yeah.
So how did ordinary Quebecers respond? Did they resist? Did they reject these efforts to essentially privatize wild game?
Yes, they did, and they did so right from the start. I mean, the first people to complain and to sort of oppose what was going on were people who were relying on fish and game either for commercial or for subsistence purposes. That was the really the first sort of site of opposition. And there's a huge variety of people that fit into that identity or into that package. We can talk about indigenous peoples, or we can talk about small-scale farmers who were taking fish and game for subsistence purposes, or maybe to give to family members or to trade at a very small sort of a scale. And then we can move on to people for whom hunting and fishing, which is now being categorized as poaching from this point on, it really represented their economic livelihood, and they were involved on it at a very large kind of a scale. So there's a good range of people that were involved. And one of the things that did is it made for considerable opportunities for conservation advocates to divide up opposition. And they did so largely by targeting commercial operators and letting other people, your farmer who takes a fish out of season or something like that, letting that sort of thing slip by and sympathizing with those sort of activities. And, behind all of that, the real truth was that there was a wide space between the law as it was written on paper and its enforcement. And despite whatever legislation may have been passed, many people continued to hunt and continued to fish regardless of the fish and game laws. Mm. And within that package, overall, the biggest success of the system was probably in curtailing large-scale commercial operations. Mm. Once we move on to the 1880s, and the impact of the clubs and the leases begins to be felt, that's the point at which we start to see sportsmen, in particular disaffected sportsmen, people who are locked out of this system, that's when we see them start to come forward and start to complain and start to lobby against this system. But overall, they didn't really have much of an impact, and this system, it continued to grow despite their opposition.
And I guess in a related question, where did Aboriginal people fit into this system of conservation?
They were locked out as well. And again, there's an incredible difference between what's written on paper and what actually happens. Mm. But on paper, at least, they were by and large locked out. That's perhaps one of the greatest problems or issues that all of this raises. And I think to some degree, a lot of the complaints on the part of civil society and the fish and game clubs were based on trying to curtail indigenous or Aboriginal use of fish and game. Mm. And that sort of spun into broader complaints more generally. That's certainly not the whole story, but I think that was an important part of it. But, I mean, aside from that, I mean, these are people who lived out in these territories and were not being monitored 24/7. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they too continued to take fish and game regardless of the laws.
Sure. And then, of course, for readers, they should remember that the provincial north of Quebec is not incorporated into the province.
No, not at all. We're really talking about a strip of territory that runs, largely populated territory that runs along the north and south shore of the St. Lawrence. Yeah. No, we're not talking about the vast sort of northern area at all here.
So by the late 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, how did this conservation system change? Did those patrician values continue to influence conservation policy?
They did, but they did in a strange kind of way. What really happened is that as that old patrician guard and those figures, you know, associated with the 1850s and 60s and into the 70s and on, as they sort of disappeared from the picture and they were replaced by sort of a new breed or another generation, and that newer generation, they were people who were less immediately inclined to that kind of patrician identity in terms of its noblesse oblige or its improvement sort of ethos that was found in their predecessors who put a lot of this together. And they were much more interested or much more focused on sport specifically. So they were different in that regard, but what they did share is that they remained fascinated by aspects of this elite or patrician sort of identity. In particular, they were very much interested in the idea that they could be part of a private hunting or a private fishing estate. Mm-hmm. And through that estate, they could express this kind of identity. And in particular, I think one of the things that was really striking from the 1880s on is you saw a good number of Americans gravitate to the system, and they began to form clubs, and they began to take out leases in the province. And in the process, the system became increasingly the domain of sort of upper and middle class urban sportsmen. And they could be from Montreal, but they could also be from New York or from Boston or from Philadelphia. And these were people who were more than happy to avail themselves of what was essentially, I think it's fair to call it, a patrician infrastructure. Mm. And I think it's in that sense, through the establishment of this infrastructure of leases and of land tenure and of estate management, that this sort of patrician culture or this patrician identity continues to influence what's going on well into the 20th century.
There's a kind of funny parallel there to the English and Scottish immigrants into Lower Canada who inherit a French-Canadian patrician culture through the seigneurial system and enjoy the benefits of it. Yeah.
Very much so, yes.
And of course, that American influence, then, do you see that as having continuities into the present? I know Quebec for hunters is still an attractive site for international tourists from the United States.
Definitely. I mean, one of the reasons it became important to retain, you know, fish and game resources and to manage a sport-based sort of system of wildlife conservation was because it had such tremendous tourism appeal by this point. In particular, for the whole eastern seaboard. I mean, by the time we hit the 20th century, if you're living in New York or Boston or Philadelphia, you can get on a train and get up to Quebec City and to a jumping-off point in less than a day. And they regularly advertised this and made this clear, and club members were well aware of this, and they could get up to their leases, you know, in a matter of 24 hours or so, and set themselves up as such. So it did certainly remain important in that regard too, well into the 20th century.
So there were hunting and fishing clubs in other jurisdictions that surrounded Quebec, in Ontario, in New Brunswick, and to the south in the United States. What did they think of the system in Quebec? What did they think of the kind of public-private partnership in wildlife conservation that emerged by the turn of the century?
Hmm. Well, there were the people who actually, from outside of the province, who actually participated in it.
Right.
And I think it's fair to say that they liked it. but apart from them, the other folks out there, they hated it. I mean, for many people who were involved in sort of conservation processes or fish and game clubs outside of Quebec, Quebec was the example by the early 20th century, the example of what not to do. And the problem for them and in general really was that, as an example, I mean, Quebec was very different, and this was a very unique sort of approach. But it was, if you looked at it, neutrally or abstractly, it was relatively effective. And sportsmen, I think in particular, feared that because it was seemed to be relatively effective, even though it was so different and so problematic, that it could become a model for other provinces and for other states to adopt as they look towards developing some sort of conservation policy, in particular the land tenure issues and the privatization that came out of it. So they rallied against it regularly. They spoke out against it. They presented it, I mean, the term was feudal. They presented it as a feudal system that was out of touch with the North American values.
Mm.
It was out of touch with the rights of ordinary people and, you know, sort of new world sport hunting and fishing context that they were trying to promote and which were obviously in their interests. I mean, if we can put out an example of that, there was an umbrella association of provincial and state and figures and interested people, stakeholders from civil society in Quebec and Ontario and New Brunswick and Nova Scotia and various states that bordered Canada in this region. They put together an umbrella group called the North American Fish and Game Protection Association.
Mm.
In that group, Quebec really stood out as being unique, and it really ended up hampering, Quebec ended up hampering efforts of these other states and provinces when they tried to develop common state or provincial policy or come up with common platforms, whenever they tried to harmonize legislation or to deal with issues like cross-border poaching or trafficking of poached goods and that sort of thing. Quebec was always a problem in that regard, and so they were not at all happy with what was going on in Quebec.
So do you suppose then that Quebec's wildlife conservation system was bumping up against the emergence of a kind of democratically inspired progressive era conservation?
Yeah, that's totally a fair comment. And it is, again, it's because it was so bizarre. I mean, the leasing of vast territories like this. It really was a system of privatization that cut across what a lot of people wanted to accomplish in this regard.
I think you've hinted at this through many of your responses already, but maybe could you take a bit of a step back now and think about Quebec more broadly in the conservation movement? What do you think that historians and scholars of wildlife conservation can learn, or how can we broaden our understanding of the conservation movement in North America by integrating Quebec's story into that broader continental history of conservation?
It's a good question because it is, I don't want to oversell it, it is unique and it is different from what is going on in a lot of other areas. I mean, in particular, the stick of Canada is very different from what goes on, say, in the prairies or even in British Columbia. But I think there are a few things we could draw out. I'll put forward three. One thing that I think we can get out of it, I think it raises the question as to what degree the kind of values that we see coming forward in Quebec were present in other parts of North America, even if the sort of infrastructure wasn't there or it wasn't institutionalized in this way. And in particular, I say that because there's nothing like it anywhere else in North America. But it was popular, and it was popular not just among some Quebecers, but among some people in other parts of North America. It drew a high degree of participation among sportsmen, elite sportsmen, in particular American sportsmen, which is quite striking. And I think in that regard, it speaks to an interest in this sort of elite, you know, quasi-feudal, old-world sort of identity that really goes well beyond Quebec. And in that regard, I think to some degree, it, I don't know if it undermines, but it certainly challenges this broader sort of egalitarian ethos that supposedly informed sportsmen in North America and certainly in the United States at this time. So I think that's interesting about it.
Mm.
Another thing that I think we could consider here is that I think it may suggest we approach things like conservation or environmentalism through the lens of governance. And this is slightly different. But I think if you look at what's going on in Quebec at this time, you have a pretty clear example of a system that combines the efforts on the one hand of the federal and the provincial governments, combines their efforts with a number of civil society institutions. We have NGOs that are devoted directly to conservation interests. We have private fish and game clubs that are also stakeholders in this system. So I think in that sense, approaching what is going on here through the lens specifically of governance has a lot to offer in terms of how we understand the development of things like conservation policy or conservation practice. But I think it has a lot of other benefits more generally to adopt that sort of governance kind of model for approaching and interpreting what's going on, be it the environment or anything else. I'll give you one more. I think more broadly, I think it says something important about environmentalism. And for me, at least, it suggests that we stop locating environmentalism as something that really sort of starts in the mid-to-late 1960s. Mm-hmm. And maybe that we can stop differentiating these kind of things in terms of talking about environmentalism as something that happens from the late 1960s on, and as conservation as something that comes before. And again, if you look at what's going on in Quebec, and there are many other examples that other people have worked on too, it's pretty clear that what's going on here it's very much a part of the environmental movement. So to sort of cut it off, you know, kind of arbitrarily as some sort of partly developed precursor to an environmental movement that really takes shape much later, I don't think it's ultimately very helpful. I think there's a lot to learn here in terms of values, in terms of attitudes, in terms of practices, in terms of questions of environmental governance and the role of, say, NGOs or of civil society, their relationship to the state. If we sort of come up to the present and we think about living in a period in which governance models are becoming increasingly important, whether we're talking about Canada or anywhere else in the world, I think it's useful to bring a historical perspective to bear on all of that. Mm-hmm. It's, among other things, a reminder that governance, whether we're talking about environmental governance or anything else, is nothing new, that it's been around for a long time.
It certainly seems to me that this book shows, too, that there was considerable diversity in wildlife conservation, that when we think about wildlife conservation continentally, you know, it's sometimes described as a movement, but it seems to me what we find in Quebec is that there are multiple movements with quite different characteristics from place to place.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. And I don't think, to be honest, I don't think you're going to find many more, certainly not clear examples, mm-hmm. I don't think Quebec will stand out as a model in that regard in terms of what's going on in North America more broadly. But I do think if you scratch the surface, you'll start to see these values playing themselves out, or tensions around these values in other parts of North America as well.
I wonder if we could play with another idea here, that in more recent environmental history scholarship in the last 10 to 15 years, historians have looked at conservation, and particularly wildlife conservation, through the lens of colonialism, mm-hmm. And in particular the impact of game laws on Indigenous people. Does the colonial lens change in the Quebec context because of the complexity of the layers of colonialism in Quebec, where you have a British colonial minority that has considerable political power, and a French-Canadian colonized majority in a territory that is originally the territory of First Nations?
Oh, definitely. And that's where it gets really complicated. I mean, we do. We have this bizarre situation in which you have a sort of ultimately British sort of power being and cultural expression being overlaid atop of a feudal kind of identity. But then you have this Aboriginal identity and Aboriginal populace that is there that links up to many of the other things that are going on in other parts of North America. But the presence of this French-Canadian identity, both on the one hand, say, the elite portions of it, mm-hmm. or the wealthier portions of it, that do tend to gravitate toward the system and participate in it. But then the larger populace that is locked out of what is going on here, that really does add another dimension to this. And I'm just borrowing your words, but to pick up on the colonial and the sort of intercolonial dimensions that are playing themselves out here, yeah, this makes it much more complicated.
Well, this is certainly a book that I think any historians who have an interest in conservation history, environmentalism, and particularly wildlife history should take a look. It, I think, absolutely adds a critical component to the story of North American conservation history that's been missing. It's called Wildlife Conservation and Conflict in Quebec, 1840 to 1914, from UBC Press. Thanks so much, Darcy.
No problem, John. Happy to be part of it.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Darcy Ingram and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes and other podcast players, and leave comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast by leaving comments or writing a short review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. You can always find out more about environmental history research in Canada from the Niche website at niche-canada.org, and you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Nature's Past.